I'm Jacob Heilbrunn, the editor of The National Interest, and my guest today is the president of the Center for the National Interest, Paul Saunders, who has also worked previously in the George W. Bush administration's State Department. And I thought it would be a good idea to talk to Paul about the reforms, or so-called reforms, that the Trump administration is proposing for the State Department. Paul, Secretary of State Rubio's announcement of major reform to the State Department is arousing a lot of controversy. Some people are defending it, others are denouncing it. What is your take on what we've seen so far?
First of all, thank you, Jacob, for having me with you today. Secondly, you know, it's hard to know what to make of the reform proposal until we really see the entire proposal. It's my understanding, you know, that that's been delivered to the Congress. But really what we're going on in the media at this point is a message from Secretary Rubio, kind of a draft organization chart that the department has released that hasn't gone yet too far down in the weeds. I think what I would say at kind of a very high level is there's probably almost no bureaucracy that couldn't be made more efficient or pared back somewhat. I think that's more or less a fact of life, and I'm sure it's probably true about the State Department too. What's really important in approaching processes like that is to do it in a careful and thorough way so that you're preserving and improving the functions of the department while kind of trimming away maybe things that don't need or are less important or may become obstacles. And, you know, in this case, I don't think we're really going to know the answer to whether or not it's an effective reform until we see the details and until we see it implemented.
Well, one thing that Secretary Rubio did write was that, quote, region-specific functions will be consolidated to increase functionality. Redundant offices will be removed and non-statutory programs that are misaligned with America's core national interests will cease to exist. Now, he did not specify which ones in that social media post, but we do know that he wants to target human rights programs and others focused on war crimes and democracy. What is your assessment of that?
Well, look, I think what the secretary appears to be doing or proposing, we should say, is breaking up a group of bureaus and offices, which are collectively now referred to as the J bureaus and offices under the undersecretary for kind of conflict and stabilization and democracy. Basically, also eliminating that undersecretary position. That's a position that came about, I don't recall exactly, but, you know, probably roughly 30 or so years ago in response to the growth of and growing importance of the so-called transnational or global issues. And it's a part of the department that historically focused on things like the environment, like human rights, like refugees, and similar issues like those that, you know, in many cases cross borders or have kind of broader impacts, and issues that you want to think about in sort of a functional way in addition to thinking about them in just a narrowly regional way. It's a part of the department that has been kind of changed over and over again by different administrations. Actually, when I was in the Bush administration, it was a somewhat different constellation of bureaus and offices than it later was under the Biden administration, most recently. So it's something that's evolving, and it's a bureau a group of bureaus, I should say, to be more precise, and offices that really changes over time in a way that often reflects political priorities of the party and the president who are in charge. And part of the reason for that is that this group of functional issues that part of the department covers, it includes some of the most domestically controversial questions in American foreign policy. For example, the Population, Refugees, and Migration Bureau, which provides a lot of historically support around the world for refugees and other things like that. It's also in charge of population, and what population kind of boils down to in many cases is what's American foreign policy related to abortion. And will the United States support United Nations and other international programs that work to increase abortion rights or that constrain abortion rights? And this is obviously something that's been quite contested in the United States. And if you look across the other bureaus and offices that are within, this cluster that seems to be the most heavily affected part of the department, there are a whole host of issues like that. International environmental policy, the question of trafficking in persons, questions of religious freedom and kind of which religious groups get the greatest priority or perhaps lesser priority from American foreign policy. You also see over time, as presidents and for that matter, also the Congress, want to draw attention to a particular issue or to demonstrate their support or commitment to advancing a particular issue or a particular group. This part of the department is often where, the Congress or the administration will create kind of new offices to reflect those kinds of political priorities. So the Office of International Women's Issues, the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. I think those are both kind of good examples of cases where the specific offices that are part of this section of the department, they're kind of used as political signaling. And I think what we're seeing now is a different kind of political signaling, the signaling of shutting down or eliminating some of those offices rather than creating them.
Well, another office that will appears that it will be closed, and which I'd be curious to get your take, is the Offices of Global Criminal Justice, which investigates war crime and conflict and stabilization operations. Do you think that is a good idea to shut it down? Is that another instance of sprawl, or does it have a specific utility?
I think that the administration has kind of signaled in broad terms already that it's much less interested than the Biden administration in promoting democracy. I think where human rights are concerned, the administration seems to have a very different sort of set of priorities in thinking about human rights than previous administrations have had, and certainly than the Biden administration or for that matter the Obama administration had. And I think some of that relates to the question of whose human rights are we trying to protect, and which specific rights are we trying to protect. And again, here, I think the current administration is kind of much less interested in trying to support and defend the rights of some of the specific groups, that Democratic administrations were looking at protecting. For example, the rights of people in the LGBTQ community. I think this administration has signaled that it's not that interested in that. And again, this is kind of a question that has been politically contested inside the United States, so it's not a surprise. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go to war crimes.
Well,
it's an important topic.
I think there are kind of two separate questions that it's important for Americans and for the U.S. government to think about in how we approach human rights generally internationally and how we approach war crimes, you know, as a specific subset of kind of human rights and international law specifically. You know, one question is having kind of clarity internationally about what American values are and what the United States stands for. And I think that historically over time, you know, it's been a considerable advantage of the United States relative to China and to Russia and some of its other competitors, rivals, adversaries around the world. So, you know, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, you know, to have that kind of clarity about where we stand. The second question is how we integrate those stands into our foreign policy decision making. And that's been, again, you know, a contested and debated issue for a long time. There are some who want to have issues of human rights or specifically war crimes be sort of the overriding consideration in shaping American foreign policy toward this or that government. And we should kind of use our values and our attitudes there to largely to define the rest of our policy. And then I think there are others who, you know, express concern that if we do that, either it can undercut our ability to achieve other important American objectives, or alternatively, and, you know, it can be or and actually, and, you know, it can also put the United States at much greater risk of appearing very hypocritical internationally, because there are inevitably circumstances when we have to compromise our own values. That's been, I think, very much a part of our policy decision making for many, many decades. And whenever we make those compromises, which we always do and will continue to do, I think that, you know, many are going to call into question how committed are we really to those values. So I think there's a little bit of a tension here, and it's something we have to think about very carefully. But I do think myself that it's important for others around the world to know where America stands on these questions.
I have a practical question for you, Paul, about Secretary Rubio's proposal, which is currently being scrutinized on Capitol Hill. How much influence do you think the Hill will have on this? And where do you think we might be headed?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to know without knowing everything that's in the proposal. But look, I mean, the Congress holds the power of the purse. There are a number of offices in the Department of State that exist specifically because the Congress wanted to create them. And the administration can't really eliminate those offices. They can what they've been doing across some other agencies and even in dealing with some kind of government funded quasi-governmental entities, you know, they can try to pare back spending to the sort of maximum possible extent that still allows those offices to conduct their basic statutory functions. I expect to see that. I certainly do expect to see, you know, some pushback from the Congress on certain things. We've already seen so far, you know, there was, a somewhat more ambitious plan that was kind of released or leaked, I guess we should say, to leak to the press. The administration has called into question whether that was a real plan or not, but it seemed to be more ambitious, and the current plan seems to be less ambitious. So I think one could argue that probably the Congress and some others on the outside have already had some impact, actually, on how the administration goes about shaping the department. But look, I mean, it's the Congress that controls the purse. And if the Congress wants to stand up and say, you have to spend X amount of money and these are the things you have to do with it, that becomes the law of the land.
Paul, let me switch to a slightly different angle, which is that there has long been apprehension, if not consternation, among conservatives about the State Department as a nest of liberals who are opposed to Republican presidents. And I think one of the most vivid examples of that came in February 1950, when Senator Joe McCarthy attacked Secretary of State Dean Acheson as, quote, a pompous diplomat in striped pants with a phony British accent, unquote. And ever since, conservatives have been leery of the State Department as practicing appeasement toward the Soviet Union or undermining Republican policies. I wondered what your take was on that, since you actually served in the Bush administration.
Look, I think there are a number of different ways to answer that question. First of all, I think by and large that federal employees at the State Department, I mean, career employees to include the Foreign Service as well as the non-Foreign Service career workforce, like the rest of the people who work for the U.S. government, I think they're basically, you know, committed people and professional people who go into their offices every day and try to do their jobs. And I would say much like the U.S. military or, other parts of the government, you know, look, they swear an oath to do their jobs. And that means following the instructions of whichever president and party happened to be in place at the time. Now, in any large organization, to include the State Department, you're going to have a lot of different perspectives politically and also in policy terms. You also get the kind of political science phenomenon of, where you stand is where you sit. And offices and bureaus in the department and the leaders of those offices and bureaus, they're going to want to defend their roles. They're going to want to defend their budgets. They're going to want to defend how many people that they get to have working in those offices. That's natural. So I think it's inevitable that those kinds of tensions emerge. But I would say, generally speaking, I think the federal workforce is kind of a loyal and professional workforce, again, at the State Department as much as anywhere else. I think that there is a little bit of a two-way street here also. And what I mean by that is that, you know, any leader who's trying to lead any large organization, and here let's just talk about the federal government as a totality, to have that workforce be an effective one, it's important to lead in and to inspire the people who are working for you so that they're enthusiastic about working for you. I think that's kind of a reality of trying to manage any organization. And if the approach is to try to lead through directives and then to kind of expect enthusiastic compliance with directives, I think that'd be challenging in any organization, you know, whether it's part of the government or not. And certainly in a corporate environment, I think that would be challenging. And in other environments, it'd be challenging. So I think ultimately, in order to kind of win over any workforce, you know, it's important to think about the people who make up that workforce and how to motivate them and get them excited and committed to doing their jobs. And, you know, to the extent that people become demoralized because they think that they're not trusted or they kind of fear for their personal futures. I think it makes it, more challenging to manage. And again, whether that's the government or any other kind of institution that somebody might try to lead.
Final question. Last year, the Lowy Institute launched something called the Global Diplomacy Index. And in it, they found that the superpowers, China and the United States, are neck and neck when it comes to diplomatic missions. China right now is ahead in Africa, East Asia, and the Pacific, while the United States has the edge in the Americas, Europe, and South Asia. However, China has about 274 posts in its global network. Washington comes in at 271. There are concerns being voiced in Washington right now that the Trump administration will be courting danger by closing some of our missions abroad. Do you think those apprehensions are warranted or are they exaggerated?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, I'm not sure that comparing the number of missions that, each country has is really that useful, because they're often kind of in different places and they're different sizes. And when you try to roll that all up into a single number, I'm not sure that's especially useful. That being said, I think that, our diplomatic missions around the world play a really key role. Certainly first and foremost, it's about representing the United States to other foreign governments, and that's sort of the basic function, and that's really important. But also, it's very much about kind of helping American citizens abroad who may encounter problems of one kind or another. And I think many Americans expect that if they get into that kind of trouble, their government will be there to help them. And if there are fewer embassies and other missions, and for that matter, fewer people at the same number of embassies and other missions, the federal government is going to be able to do less, to help Americans who get into those kinds of situations. But thirdly, I'm not sure, to what extent people appreciate that embassies around the world, ours and everyone else's, are also engaged in, I think, what one would fairly call sort of open collection of intelligence. And here I don't mean, spies or secret activity or anything like that. I mean that we have embassy officials who are moving around the cities where they're stationed, and in most cases, the countries where they're stationed. They're meeting people, they're talking to people, they're out on the street, they're taking the pulse, they're collecting that information, they're distilling it, they're sending it back to the department in Washington. And in many ways, our diplomats are kind of the eyes and ears of the United States overseas. And when we take that away, then we really lose visibility in many cases into these other societies. I mean, yes, you can, read the newspaper, you can watch what they put on TV. You can vacuum up what goes on to social media and run it through some kind of algorithm and try to calculate, what people think. But it's not the same as going and talking to real people, again, or around these various countries and collecting their views. Why is it, by the way, that some governments, impose limits on where American officials, diplomats, can go in their countries? Because there are some, that do things like that. Why does that occur? It occurs because they want to constrain our ability to collect that information. That kind of suggests that information is helpful for us, and also that, they may not want us to have all of it. So I think it's really important for the United States to continue to have a big diplomatic presence around the world so that we can engage, so that we can help Americans, and so that we can collect this information that we need.
Paul, your points are extremely well taken, and thank you for coming on and sharing these insights.
Thanks very much, Jacob. Happy to be with you.